Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 34. Thank you, Momar.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, joined today with three illustrious panelists to talk about the latest in internet law. One of our panelists is a newcomer to the show, Kevin Warbach, and is actually teaching internet law back at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, Kevin. Great to have you on the show.
Great to be here. My pleasure.
Kevin is one of the Earth's oldest bloggers, B-L-A-W-G-E-R. In fact, with you and me and Ernie and Evan on the phone here today, I think we've got the early blogosphere on the legal front fairly well covered. So I'm really glad to have the chance to finally get you on the show. Kevin is also the founder, creator, impresario for the Supernova conference that is coming up in December. And I'm really looking forward to that too. One other thing you should know about Kevin, and I hope we can get into this in some of our stories on the show, is he assisted the Obama transition team in reviewing the FCC. So I'm really interested to hear about that as we get underway here today.
Love to.
Okay. Also with us, Ernie Svensson from New Orleans and ErnieTheAttorney.com or .net, excuse me. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, good to be here, and great to be here with Kevin finally to get a chance to meet and talk to him. I'm looking forward to it.
And Evan Brown from InternetCases.com also here with us today. Hey, Evan.
Hey, how's it going? Good afternoon.
Going great. So some housekeeping things here on the front end. We are live, and apologies for anyone who's been hanging in waiting for the show to go live. We got a little bit of a late start due to technical difficulties today, but we're live at live.twit.tv. You can join us interactively in not just one or two, but three ways today. And actually, there's more if you're on Ustream or Stick'em, where I think the show also streams live, but I'm not monitoring those chats. I am monitoring irc.twit.tv, and we have a friend feed chat going at friendfeed.com/twill or denise.howell.net/twill34. And for fun, we've been doing this for a good part of the morning. We have a wave for the show, and I set up a short URL for the wave. That's at denise.howell.net/wave34. So if you are one of the folks who's been giving Google Wave a try, jump in and join our wave for the show. And we've had people chiming in there this morning about the show notes and different things we're going to talk about today. So it's fun to kind of kick the tires on it. I'm rather impressed with myself for managing to actually share a link to a wave. It's the first public one I've ever done. And huge thanks to TWiT's own Gina Trapani from This Week in Google and Life Hacker and Smarterware. Google should have her on the payroll as the best Wave ambassador out there because she is making it usable for the rest of us. So thank you, Gina, so much for all your help. And thanks to everyone who's jumped into the Wave this morning. No pun intended. So, Kevin, tell us about working with the administration and how that all unfolded. How did you even get contacted by them and asked to serve that role?
Well, I was at Taco Bell, and someone just gave me a little card, and it said, "Would you like to be on the Obama transition team?" And I said, "Sure, great. You know, I've won something." Isn't that how it happens for everyone?
I suppose. Who else? Was it Rebecca who was doing it with you, or who was your co-review person for the FCC?
Oh, Susan Crawford.
Susan Crawford.
So I've been, I actually, I don't know if I should take offense at you calling me old earlier on this. it's sort of, I guess, maybe I've been a blogger for a long time. I don't think I'm all that old. But anyway, I've been involved in technology policy and communications policy for a long time. I worked at the FCC during the Clinton administration. I was in charge of internet policy there in the mid-1990s and have stayed active in the area. Back in 2007, when President Obama started his campaign, I got involved with a group of folks on what was called the Technology, Media, and Telecommunications Advisory Committee. There were a series of policy committees on different topics that the campaign put together with experts in various areas. So the technology group worked on developing the technology agenda for the administration. Turns out it had a very large percentage of the top thinkers and practitioners that I respect that are involved in telecom policy. They were all early on supporters. When President Obama got elected, he and his team had to put together a transition team. The transition is an operation with roughly 400 people or so who work in the time between the election and inauguration in January to basically set up the new administration and figure out what the agenda should be, help with the selection of the key officials in the administration and the early development of the budget. So I was fortunate enough to get asked to co-lead the review team for the Federal Communications Commission with Susan Crawford, who's a law professor at Michigan, who's now working in the White House, and also worked very closely with the other groups that we're doing the various technology policy efforts, most of whom are now also in the government. So it was a wonderful experience.
So what was the first order of business? I have some limited knowledge of what happens during an administration changeover from a friend of mine who worked in the State Department a long time ago. And from what I recall, there are some people who have spots that endure from one administration to the next and some people who don't. Were you vetting who got to stay and who got to go, or what was your role exactly?
Yeah, not at that level. So there are thousands and thousands of jobs in the federal government, and there are a substantial number of them that are even what you might think of as high-level jobs, the jobs that actually have to get confirmed by the U.S. Senate. There are some positions that are political positions. Every agency has certain positions that basically turn over when a new administration comes in, unless they for some reason want to keep the person in office. The bulk of people who work for the federal government are civil servants. So the vast majority of jobs are not political. Those people have a guarantee that they won't lose their job when someone else takes over. The part of the transition process was the personnel process. So the administration had to pick a cabinet and also the senior officials below the cabinet level. I wasn't directly involved in those selections, but the whole transition process was involved in developing the information for the people who were doing the selections. And then once the selections happen, we were the ones developing the information for the people who were put into those positions or nominated for those positions in terms of what they would need for their confirmation and what they would need to help run their agencies. So again, I was very involved with the process for the FCC as well as some of the other technology-related parts of the government, helping identify what the issues were and supporting the people who were making the selections.
So from a policy standpoint, were you involved in trying to come up with points that the administration would refer back to over time as issues came before the FCC, or was it more of a preliminary, let's get up and going and go from there kind of role?
It's some of both. The 2.5 months or so that I was on the transition is the hardest I've ever worked in my life, and I work hard a lot of the time, but it was extraordinary and wonderful because I got to do it on something I really cared about with a fantastic group of people. It was just unbelievable the level of talent
on the transition, and then just who would come through the office every day, people who were meeting with us and people who were working to support us. We had it easy somewhat in that I work on tech policy, and we were working for a president who gets it. It's famously Obama has a BlackBerry. He's someone who is really understanding about information technology and communications. This was an area that, quite frankly, the previous administration, the Bush administration, didn't care a lot about, and one that this administration cared a great deal about. So a lot of what we were doing was the nuts and bolts. But once you get into any of these federal agencies, there's a tremendous amount of nuts and bolts. And just to literally come in and keep the lights on and keep the place running operationally is tremendously complicated. And there's a great deal of staff that stick around. But just getting the information that you need to make the handover effectively is a lot of work. But we did more than that. We really were trying to help map out what the issues were and what the options were, so that when the people came into office, so Julius Genachowski, who I've known for a long time, he was part of the transition as well. He was nominated and subsequently confirmed as the chairman of the FCC. We wanted to make sure that he could hit the ground running. And it's he's the one who makes the decisions. We couldn't make any decisions, but we wanted to give him and his team the information that they would need so that they didn't have to take months getting up to speed. As it turned out, of course, he wasn't nominated until March. He wasn't confirmed until the end of June. So the transition process was going a million miles an hour and did a lot of essential work to get things going. But then there was a lag before at the FCC anything could be put into place.
So net neutrality, obviously a big issue, probably one at the top of the list as you were discussing issues with the transition team. We have a couple of stories that have been percolating up about Google Voice. One is a few weeks old, so I don't think we have an actual link to it in our discussion points yet, but I'm sure people will recall the tussle between Apple and Google over whether Google Voice was going to have an app on the iPhone and whether the FCC was going to get involved in that at all. Were you paying attention to that, Kevin, and do you have any thoughts along those lines?
Definitely paying attention. So I'm actually now still consulting for the FCC after the transition and Chairman Genachowski took over. They engaged me to be an advisor on a part-time basis on some issues. So I'm limited in what I can say, and whatever I say is just my own personal viewpoints. It's not anything the FCC is doing. But I've definitely been following it. The whole issue of network neutrality and really more broadly the nature of the open internet is a critically important one. And I think what Chairman Genachowski has said since taking over in a few speeches and interviews is that he thinks it's critical that the government look at what it takes to ensure the internet remains the kind of open, competitive environment for innovation that it has been for such a long time. A huge question is how that applies to wireless. So wireless is in many ways the internet of the future. It's growing explosively. Smartphones, devices like the iPhone are just skyrocketing in usage. And it's extraordinary what's developing. The vast number of apps, for example, on the iPhone is revolutionary. And other companies are doing similar sorts of things. There's lots of great potential. But the wireless industry has traditionally had a very different business model. It's traditionally had a business model where the carriers, the network operators, pick the phones, they pick the applications, they pick the interface, they control very much what happens on the platform. And that's not inherently a bad approach, but it's a different one from the internet. And as the internet converges with the mobile world, there's a big important question about how those things come together. So what I think the FCC has done is basically said, we think these are important issues, and we think that it's valuable to have the agency ask questions, try to understand what's going on, and use the mechanisms it has to get information and to get discussions going to look at these questions. So they sent a letter to Apple and AT&T and Google about some of the issues. And then they sent another letter to Google just recently when AT&T started pointing out that Google Voice doesn't complete calls to certain phone numbers. And I think all that, you know, again, my personal view, I think it's all healthy. The FCC hasn't committed to doing anything here. It's taking a look at the issues and trying to raise awareness and discussion of this critical question. There are two sides. There's a side that says, in order to run their business, the carriers and the handset manufacturers need to have a great deal of control. But I think there's an important point that says let's look at how we got to where we are today with the internet, where we got something like Skype that we're able to do this call on. It didn't happen because an internet service provider came up with the great idea of doing a proprietary service called Skype. It happened because some innovators and developers were able to build something on an open platform. And so I think it's a critical set of questions about how that goes forward. The FCC will very shortly be putting out what's called a notice of proposed rulemaking, a request for comment on the broader issue of the open internet, and Chairman Jenikowski has already started talking about some of the policies that he thinks are appropriate there. But that's really going to kick off an open comment process where people can weigh in on these issues, and I certainly hope a lot of people do.
So Google Voice and Skype, and well, maybe not Google Voice. There's some discussion about this in our Wave on the show, and I don't know enough about how the back end works to understand whether it is a voice over IP service or not. But Skype is, as I understand it. And as I also understand it, those sorts of telecommunications services are treated differently than our conventional landline telephones for purposes of the FCC. Do you think that that's appropriate? And, you know, as we see this convergence and blurring of lines between what is an internet company and what is a telecommunications company, where do you see things going in the future?
Mm-hmm. So we could geek out on this in intimate, extraordinary detail, because it gets complicated when you get into the regulatory structure. The first thing I would say is it's not a new question. So when I was at the FCC in 1997, so 12 years ago now, I wrote a paper called Digital Tornado that was a working paper that was put out by the FCC that was about the internet and telecom policy. And I was certainly not the first to raise these questions even then, but it talked about the issue of the internet converging with telecom and the question of how the traditional rules, which make a very sharp distinction between what's called a regulated telecommunications service and what was understood as an unregulated, quote, information service, as those come together, what to do about the gray areas. The approach that the FCC took, which I think was a good one, starting around that time, was to say that it didn't want to rush to apply the old rules to new services. It didn't want to immediately try to apply 100 years of telecommunications regulation, which was designed for big facilities-based monopoly service providers, to these new voice over IP services. But what that included, that kind of approach, was ultimately a recognition that sooner or later these were issues that had to be addressed. And I think we're at the point now where the FCC needs to figure this out. And it's made various decisions. It basically has decided that under the prior administration, so this was before President Obama took over, the FCC concluded that broadband internet access was an information service. So it's not subject to these rules. And it's made some general statements about voice over IP services, but it's never specifically considered what the dividing line is. And the Google Voice case, the case where they're not connecting certain calls, puts it very squarely. If Google Voice were a telecommunications service, if it were a telephone company, it would be subject to what's called common carrier rules, and it couldn't decide which calls to connect. The way the FCC has looked at this kind of service so far, it's not. It's an information service, and so they're not subject to those rules. But I think it's a fair question to ask where they come together.
And does anybody? I mean, I think that we're in agreement that it's a fair question to ask, and that that this letter that the AT&T folks have sent the FCC makes some valid points, but there is some delicious irony to hearing AT&T sing the praises of net neutrality and lambast Google for its stance here when historically Google has been the champion of that issue in Washington. Evan, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it's as you characterize, delicious irony, and it also just goes to show that if we scratch a little bit below the surface and look at what's not being said by AT&T, it's interesting to see the motivations that AT&T might have. I mean, clearly there's a competitive threat going on here, and it's interesting to see that they've crafted this kind of argument to bring the issue to the forefront and to press it so that there's going to be some kind of resolution in the rulemaking process, hopefully. Just as a general observation on all of this, I find it interesting because, like so many issues involving how the law approaches evolving technology, there's not going to be any good way that I see in my mind to draw a line here on what's within the jurisdiction of the FCC and what's not. As Kevin was pointing out, you know, it's a meaningful inquiry to make that. But just like we were talking last episode about the DMCA and how the DMCA should apply to intermediaries, it's all a question of scale. Once a provider gets so massive, does that affect where you draw the line on what their obligations and their responsibilities would be? When you read the letter that AT&T sent to the FCC earlier this week, you know, it goes much farther than talking about Google Voice. And in fact, I would imagine that if you were to actually count the number of lines dedicated to topics other than Google Voice, that those other topics might take up a higher percentage of the bulk of this letter. They go on to talk about, AT&T goes on to talk about, you know, the risk that Google runs in connection with its search services. It's just become so powerful. And the point being here is that these questions and these lines get difficult to be drawn just based on the extraordinary magnitude of the service that Google has put upon us here, and many would say that it has earned this position.
Yeah, Kevin? That's a good point. No, and you know, there are some academics who've written papers talking about Google being subject to some of these rules, Google search engine as a key platform that should be open. I mean, the first thing is you know, that it's you're absolutely right. They're hard issues, and I think the FCC is doing the right thing in having a very open process. There's a website at openinternet.gov. They have a blog. They have a mechanism for public comment and discussion. They're trying to put the information up there. They're having public workshops and all sorts of mechanisms to get these views in. Ultimately, there are ways that we can parse the Communications Act, and you know, wearing my academic hat, I have a paper that's coming out in a law review in the spring called "Off the Hook," that looks at, you know, the precise legal nuances of how you could support this under the Communications Act. But the broader policy question is, anyone who says that there's a black and white line here, I mean, the argument that gets made, anything that happens is, quote, regulating the internet and we should just avoid regulating the internet, is kind of misleading. The reality is this is the fundamental communications platform of our age, and government shouldn't overregulate it. But, if markets are not going to themselves produce the kind of openness and innovation that they should, then I think it's valuable to look at the role government can play, which again it did with the internet. But I think you're absolutely right. This letter from AT&T and the whole debate they're stirring up is about a whole lot more than Google Voice. And you know, frankly, Google understands this. There's lots of talk already about antitrust action against Google. They've grown up really quickly, but the reality is they're at that point today.
And we've seen litigation on other matters going after Google. I mean, I'm thinking of, I think it was called the Kinderstart case from 3 or 4 years ago, just talking about this. I mean, that was it, like kind of, I think it, there were a lot of First Amendment issues on that case of whether or not it was proper for Google to be able to, you know, the allegations were that Google was arbitrarily manipulating PageRank. So for at least several years now, the people have recognized this very broad and general notion of how extraordinary Google's power is. And that's something that's interesting in this letter, is this description about how Google can really shape the direction of discourse and manipulate the channels that ideas flow through, just in small things, just like by what search results they put out. So it's a very dramatic position that AT&T takes in this, and we have to remember that while reading the letter. But nonetheless, it's very effective and combustible kindling for discussion on this.
Yeah, toward the subject of hidden agendas here, Foxtrot in our wave is pointing out that there are fees involved in the connections that Google is declining to make, that AT&T is required to make because it is regulated, and that the agenda there may be just to have the FCC decide, well, perhaps those fees shouldn't apply to anybody. So I guess there's multiple axes to be ground, and hopefully we can we have smart people there who can sort through them. One thing I wanted to ask you, Kevin, and I think Ernie's dropped off the call for a second, hopefully we can get him back on, is whether you think that there's an overlap, not just between telecommunications services and internet services, but between the role of the FCC and the FTC, and perhaps even the Justice Department. As you read through this letter, the AT&T letter to the FCC about Google Voice, there is a whole lot of discussion of market dominance and potentially anti-competitive activities that, when I read it, struck me as, you know, interesting subject matter to raise with the FCC. Do you think it has a role there? And what do you think folks at the FCC think when they read something like that?
Well, I wouldn't purport to speak for them, but no, you raise a good point. And the world is converging, and communication is a platform. This is, you know, to go back to the transition. I mean, something that we talked about a lot, and I think you saw coming out of the administration early on, was this recognition that there's a lot of overlap between key areas. So even things as far off as you know, transportation and healthcare and economic development, you know, technology and broadband and communications are essential platforms for it. So things come together, and one way they come together is how different parts of the government relate to something. So there always has been some overlap between the antitrust function of the Justice Department, the consumer protection function of the Federal Trade Commission, and the communications regulation function of the FCC. There's some specific areas where they have defined areas of responsibility, and then some areas that, frankly, are a jump ball. And you know, both the FTC and the Justice Department Antitrust Division have very smart, very aggressive, very tech-savvy new leadership. I am certain that they're in close contact, as appropriate, with the FCC to figure out the best way to address issues. And, you know, some of the issues that are coming up now are fundamentally about consumer protection. And the Federal Trade Commission has a lot of expertise in dealing with that and dealing with complaints. They statutorily can't deal with complaints about common carriers. So, again, those regulated phone companies, they're excluded from, unless the Congress changes the statute. But these are not common carrier services. So I think there's a role for the FTC in consumer protection. But when you get into the technical expertise about the guts of the network, that's what the Federal Communications Commission understands. So I think you'll see a lot of back and forth on these issues, and also coordinating with the Justice Department as well. I mean, they're the ones who would get involved in any kind of antitrust action about Google or anyone else. So yeah, there's no question that there's a lot of overlap.
So let's shift gears here and talk for a second about the FTC's recent decision that they are going to roll out rules as of December, guidelines for disclosures by folks using internet services like weblogs. And we won't even get into the overlap issue of what happens when you are using services that don't touch the internet for this sort of thing. But the FTC has decided that bloggers and others have been playing fast and loose with what they are disclosing as far as how they're being compensated when they are out there endorsing or plugging or giving positive reviews to items that they may have been sent for free. Of course, this is something that journalists have dealt with for a long time, but who would not be necessarily subject to this same FTC regulation. And I, as all of you, as we talked about, are bloggers and use the internet for various kinds of communications, I'm wondering what each of you thinks about this, and I would point our listeners to this great post that Jeff Jarvis put up called Plug Ad Opinion Life. Is this a story or an ad? It matters. And he goes on to lay out sort of a classic law school exam question kind of scenario where he posts about his experience at Radio Shack and Best Buy and says something positive about Best Buy and then steps back and looks at the meta issue of, you know, if he has properly disclosed what he needs to in order to make that positive statement and not run afoul of these new FTC rules, which are going to involve some hefty fines. So, Ernie, you know, you and I have been blogging side by side across the country for quite some time. Is this going to change the way that you approach your posts?
Well, it already has in a small way. I mean, when this first came up, I didn't really think it was going to be something that would apply to somebody as small of a, you know, a small blog like mine, which I don't know how people categorize blogs, but mine, you know, pales in comparison to, for example, TechCrunch or some other larger blogs. And it seemed to me that the rules clearly would apply to TechCrunch and blogs where, you know, those people were actually making a significant amount of money, or that was how they made money. And in my case, I mean, the only reason I ever added anything to my blog to make money off of it was when Google first came out with their ad program, or at least when I first became aware that it would apply to blogs. I was curious how it worked, so I put the ads in there just to learn about it. Then I discovered, to my amazement, that I had two blogs, you know, Ernie the Attorney, which was the one that most people know about, and then PDF for Lawyers, which was to talk about how lawyers might use PDFs in the practice of law. Well, the PDF for Lawyers blog got like 1/3 of the traffic that my other, you know, the attorney blog got. And yet when I put these Google ads on each one, that one generated 3/4 of the revenue that I got. So I learned that, you know, being niche focused and talking about something in a specialized way was the way to make money if you wanted to do that. So I left that up, and, you know, and then I added the Amazon links. And so I do make money, and I make enough money to cover the cost of hosting and, you know, buy an occasional Amazon gift at a discounted rate. But the question is, how much do I need to disclose to people about that? And to me, it's a common sense thing. You know, whether I don't need the FTC guidelines to tell me that if I'm going to use this mechanism to try to make money and to steer people in a way so that I make more money, and that's going to influence what I say or what I talk about, then I should disclose that, because people should know what my bias is and where I'm coming from. So I did change, and I'm going to change it some more. I changed my main blog, and I put up a post saying, here are all of the rules that govern this blog and whether you want to comment. And in there, I put in a bit about, you know, how I accept advertising and what the advertising means to me, and that, in fact, when it comes to the Amazon stuff, because that's really the only thing I think that people would know about. I mean, the advertisements that I accept are on the left. People know those are ads. I really don't even have control over them other than to approve them. But the Amazon stuff is typically things that I link to, and so I'll review a product. The Fujitsu scanner, for example, I think is a great, you know, tool, so I'll talk about that, and I'll link to it, and yeah, I get a cut off of that, but, you know, I think people should know that, okay, so and they know that, but what I said in the post was that I think the Amazon situation is kind of different, and I like Amazon because when you link people to that product page, there are other reviews there that are more important than mine. And I said, you know, whether I make money off it or not, I think people should know that that's a great way to find out whether you want to buy that product. So anyway, that's a long-winded story, I guess, to say it does apply to me. I have changed what I do as to the Amazon stuff, because I think that's the one area where people might not know, okay, fine, Amazon pays people 4% of that product if they buy it. They don't pay any more for it than they would. It just you know, I get 4%, you know, a couple of months down the road if they've actually bought and paid for it. Is that really what the FTC is going after? I mean, if so, that's going to include a lot of people. And I think eventually everybody will need to disclose that they're getting Amazon referral links.
Yeah, I went ahead and updated. I have a little page off my Squarespace site / blog at bagandbaggage.com that has, you know, it's set up to do Amazon links. And it has been there ever since I did the switch over several months back to using that service. But it's not set up with any kind of disclosure of what kind of links that are being offered there. So I did go in and put in a bit of text that says, yo, these are affiliate links. And hopefully people understand what that means. I did link to the affiliate program so that people can understand all about that if they want to. You know, it's not like those generate enough even to, you know, buy a cappuccino on any kind of regular basis. But I think with these guidelines and rules coming into place, that caution is in order. I mean, the fines of up to $11,000 are nothing to mess around with. From a policy standpoint, Kevin, can you see any reason why the FTC might choose to treat sort of your day-to-day amateur journalist, citizen journalist, differently than the professional journalists are treated in this way? I mean, can you imagine if people at Gourmet Magazine or travel magazines had to disclose all of the perks and benefits they get in connection with their jobs and the positive reviews that they write?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I can't comment on the specifics of what the FTC is trying to do, but that, I mean, this is the whole issue, right? Isn't it with bloggers and new media? These lines are blurring. So you have people, for example, who are professional journalists who have blogs, and the in the journalism world, when they're a New York Times reporter, they have very strict rules on what they can do, what, you know, what kind of financial interest they can have, whether they can pay for dinner for a source or anything like that. Although that there's not a box on the front of the New York Times that lists all of that. There's tremendous restrictions on what their professional journalist reporters can do. But then they go and write a blog on their thoughts of something, and there's none of those practices standardized, and I think there's a healthy debate going on about which of them are appropriate and necessary. This is another one like what we talked about before with you know, the law can make a distinction and say you're either a telecommunications company or an information service provider. Similarly, we can draw a line and say, okay, you're a professional journalist and you're not. But this world we're in, that's just going to get blurred very quickly. And, so you take something like, you know, Mike Arrington at TechCrunch, who, you know, when I met him in 2005 was, you know, an entrepreneur who was kind of starting a company and throwing up some posts about things that he was seeing in the market. No one would have thought of him as a journalist, and now he has a very successful site, he of course is pushing a lot on this question about what are appropriate standards, but things can change, I think it's good that the FTC action is causing us to think about this stuff. The reality is, there's no way they can make a bright line distinction. You can't say, you know, a journalist is someone who has the following on his or her business card or, you know, went to journalism school or something, because none of those things make sense anymore. So they're going to need to come up with a rule that defines different cases and potentially refine what they've already done. And then they're going to have to be judicious in enforcement. Because the reality is, there can be rules that say, in theory, there are fines for anyone who's in this situation. But the government doesn't go after every single person who, you know, could have been, you know, theoretically found in violation of a rule. They look at what's going on. And I think, you know, there's no track record right now. And I think as there get to be best practices, as, for example, if you need to disclose Google ads, then maybe Google will, you know, build that into their affiliate link system so that automatically happens on your blog. That sort of thing. We're just early on in terms of getting to that.
Kevin, you raise a good point there about automating this process of disclosure. And I guess what I'm doing right now is giving a shout out. So here's our second instance of irony in the call today. Am I endorsing a product by saying this? But there is a new service called Comply, which is CMP.ly that came out. And full disclosure, it's my buddies who are involved with it. So I don't know what kind of disclosure I need to make there. But what it does is it's a little bit it summons the spirit of Creative Commons in a way. You just provide a little short URL that you could even include in a tweet that links to a page that has a human readable disclosure statement. You know, it's like I got a free copy, or I got a free sample, or I'm being paid, or I'm an employee. So a different link, you know, for the different level of disclosure. Backing up just a little bit, I mean, a couple of observations that I have about this whole notion here is that, you know, clearly the FTC is going to need to be judicious in its enforcement of this. And I think that if we read the materials that came out with the new guidelines, we are getting a little bit of a hint as to how, you know, they will be so judicious. The first thing is really an acknowledgement on their part that they don't have the staff to go after every possible instance of a violation of these guidelines. And then the second kind of big hint to us here is the fact that they put a big burden on the advertisers rather than, you know, the individual endorsers themselves. I'm looking at page 15 of the whole, you know, packet that came out of, you know, from the FCC that kind of lead up to the actual guides themselves. And it talks
FTC,
about
FTC, you mean, right?
Oh, geez, did I say that?
We have a bit of alphabet soup on today.
Trying really hard not to, but yeah. But what the FTC says, it says the commission, in the exercise of its prosecutorial discretion, would consider the advertisers, you know, the detergent manufacturer, the advertisers' efforts to advise the endorsers of their responsibilities and to monitor their online behavior in determining what action, if any, would be warranted. So, you know, people are scared, thinking like, oh my gosh, these guidelines are going to totally, you know, make it rough for me. I'm going to get fined $11,000 every time I open my mouth or, you know, put Pixel to screen. But like so many other things, I think that's a kind of a sky is falling, you know, reaction to this. The biggest point really here is that there is no new law on the books. These do not establish new forms of liability. All this is an indication as to how the FTC, you know, would go after instances of what they would believe or what it would believe to be unfair, deceptive trade practices. So it doesn't. And if I'm saying this, you know, too generally or overstating it, Kevin or anyone else on the call, please correct me. But it doesn't really change the whole risk of liability that one would have if he or she were making some kind of statement online that was likely to not be in the best interest of the consumer from the FTC's standpoint.
So, Evan, you advise folks who are foraying into online communications, I assume. This,
yes.
This rulemaking strikes me as the kind of thing that would be ripe for some kind of client alert discussion, especially when it rolls out in December, about, you know, what you can do to protect yourself in the wake of this new statement from the FTC. If you were putting together such an alert, what would you include in it, and how would you deal with some of these murkier areas?
Well, I don't want to pick nits too much with what you said, but these aren't new rules. And I think that's important for us to keep that in mind, because they, unlike rules would, these don't have the binding effect of law. They're just guidelines that give us an insight into the mind of the FTC. I'm right on that, right, Kevin?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know the FTC's process quite as well as the FCC.
Yeah, well, my administrative law teacher, you know, from law school would be pulling for me right now to be doing this, you know, answering this correctly. But going to your question, Denise, I mean, I feel like I say this a lot on the show, but a little bit of common sense is going to go a long way. If you're a publisher, you know, using social media out there, I think that it's these are definitely something that you should take seriously and something that you should, you know, keep in mind when you are actually publishing this. But at the same time, I am not going to come out and tell somebody that this is going to be a real game-changing event. Certainly, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not telling anybody to disregard what the FTC is saying here, but I think we just need to give this the credit, the credence that it's worth. It needs to be paid the attention that it's worth. But at the end of the day, it should not change somebody's common sense attitude toward the kind of content that they put out there and the positive statements that they may say about a particular good or service. In many instances where you're talking about goods and services, you're not going to fall under the rubric of these guidelines because, if you're acting independently, if you just happen to really, really like, a certain kind of burrito that you get down at the corner shop, there's not going to be any kind of concern with, making some kind of statement that could be an unfair or deceptive trade practice. So many of the things that people publish about anyway when they're raving about stuff or giving shout outs wouldn't fall under these guidelines anyway. So perhaps to summarize what I've said, they should be taken seriously, but I don't think anybody should be losing any sleep over them. And to the extent you have any doubts, use a great service like Comply, CMP.ly. It got a shout out on Mashable this morning too. I'm not getting paid.
I have seen that being bandied about or something like it. They may have competitors. I'm not sure exactly which one I saw. But I liked the way that it did have both a human-readable and machine-readable aspect to it so that you could have some sort of flag or pointer that would immediately tell you just by a visual cue and also, your computer would know.
Right, and it's also cool because it's so short. It uses the Libyan country code domain, it's cmp.ly, that it could fit in a tweet without taking up too much of your space there. So we've put up this question before about what kind of disclosures you could or should make in a tweet when you've got to be so careful with not using up all 140 characters. This answers that question as well, or at least provides some salve. To take the sting out of using up so many characters in your individual tweet.
So we should thank the government of Libya for their contribution to the internet.
Exactly. Who would have known that Muammar Gaddafi would have been so helpful in making sure that the American consumer is spared from deceptive and unfair trade practices?
If I could just jump in here with one other thing. I mean, we should also remember what this is all about, which is it's about disclosure. And I don't want to disregard some of the potentially overbroad things that could happen, and people should understand what the FTC rules say. But I would think that part of what's animating this process there is to push people to think about the value of disclosure, because you don't have to worry about how much space there is in the back of your magazine to put a disclosure online. And in general, more information is good, even if people don't necessarily read it. I think it's valuable to have an ethic as much as possible, whether or not it's to comply with some specific legal requirement, to try and put information out there and not hide it. And it sort of ties in with what we were discussing before in terms of antitrust and Google and so forth. Google's view, at least as I understand it, as to why they shouldn't be subject to antitrust liability despite their great size, is don't be evil. That's the motto of our company. And if you talk to people at Google, that actually means something to them. And I'm not going to take a position on whether that ultimately means anything or not from a legal standpoint. But they do have a culture that gets people to think about what does it mean to be evil or not. And sometimes they don't live up to that, and it's harder as they become a bigger company. But that's part of the culture, and I think disclosure is part of the culture of the net to begin with. And I think as these services get more and more economically significant, I think it's important for everyone as a blog, no matter how big or how small, to think about how they can do that.
Yeah, it's one of the things that makes America great is the fact that we have a marketplace where you can rely on certain statements that are made, to the extent that they're an advertisement. So I like what you said about, being the mantra of don't be evil. It'd be interesting to see, you know, a litigated matter where the question before the court is the party evil as a matter of law? So that would be quite entertaining.
That would be a
draw. I'd like to see that
famous law school case where the guy tries to sue Satan and his minions for hindering him in his life.
That's a classic.
To bring
one.
A claim against Satan and the judge. The judge dismisses it for lack of jurisdiction, actually.
Well, I don't know that I'm able to lend or we're able to lend a whole lot of clarity to this issue of the fine on the FTC guidelines. It seems like that it's still up in the air and that Richard Cleland, an assistant director for the Division of Advertising Practices at the FTC, came out and said last week that, and I'm getting this from Paid Content, who I believe got it from Fast Company, the $11,000 fine is not true. Worst case scenario, someone receives a warning, refuses to comply, followed by a serious product defect. We would institute a proceeding with a cease and desist order and mandate compliance with the law. There's no monetary penalty in terms of the first violation, even in the worst case. So, you know, who knows what that means as far as subsequent violations. The Interactive Advertising Bureau wants the FTC to put all this in writing and make sure no fines will be handed down, but apparently that hasn't been done yet. So,
yeah, there's all kinds of wiggle room even in what they're saying there. I mean, it's just as broad as I can't think of the appropriate, you know, rural metaphor, agrarian metaphor to use here, but, you know, my grandparents on the farm would have had a good one here. You know, I mean, it's clear that they're going to evaluate on a case-by-case basis. If there's something that's particularly egregious and somebody is really doing a lot of damage out there, you know, they've got the FTC has more than one way of getting things done pretty quickly. But as far as the run-of-the-mill things, you know, clearly, I don't think everybody should be expecting to get fined 11 grand just for every blog post they make that might run afoul of this.
Well, I do want to get to talking about Google Wave at some point and apologize to our listeners for the fact that in this particular show, it's the first time we've used a wave in connection with the show, and I'm thinking that all of us are sort of taking a break from the wave to do the show as opposed to the opposite. So I want to talk about the legal ramifications of Wave and its unique way of communicating. And I also want to talk about some other more interesting policy and government considerations with Kevin and the woman who got arrested for poking someone on Facebook. But first, before we go further, I do want to thank our sponsor and disclose that we have a sponsor for the show, Audible.com, who has been with us from the get-go and is one of my favorite services on the web. And I would say that if they were not a sponsor of the show, because I have used Audible going way, way back to the late 90s when they first came online as a service, and I had a horrific commute in my life, and they made it manageable. And one of the things I remember listening to way back then, I'm going to go ahead and recommend as a download for our listeners, if you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can download this for free and get a 14-day free trial of the Audible Gold program. And the book that I'm going to recommend, you know, we may have recommended it on Twill before, and my apologies if I'm being duplicative, but it's such a good book that I think it deserves a second recommendation, and probably a lot of our listeners have already listened but could use a revisit of it, because I know I'm going to do that. And it is Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. I haven't listened to it for quite some time. The unabridged version narrated by Jonathan Davis is available on Audible. There is an abridged version also if you're looking for that, but I do recommend the unabridged version. And the reason that my interest in this is re-peaked is I've been learning how to skateboard with my son. And this Neal Stephenson's treatment of skateboarding in this book is quite wonderful. And there is something that he's invented that perhaps one day we will see as an innovation in skateboarding technology called smart wheels, which use sonar, laser range finding, and millimeter wave radar to identify mufflers and other debris. Each one consists of a hub with many tiny spokes. Each spoke telescopes into five sections On the end is a squat foot, rubber tread on the bottom, swiveling on a ball joint. And as the wheel rolls, the feet plant themselves one at a time, almost glomming into one continuous tire. If you surf over a bump, the spokes contract to roll over it. If you surf over a pothole, the rubber prongs probe its asphalt depths. Either way, the shock is thereby absorbed. No thuds, smacks, vibrations, or clunks will make their way into the plank or the Converse high tops with which you tread it. So,
wow. And if that device can be self-repairing, we'll really be onto something there. The perfect
someone
machine.
I frequently, topple off the board at inappropriate times, like right in the middle of intersections. So I could really use someone to come along and listen to Snow Crash on Audible and become inspired to update our current level of technology in the skateboarding world. So audiblepodcast.com/twill, where you can find Snow Crash, the entire wonderful, well, I don't know if they have every single one, but a huge selection of other Neal Stephenson works, wonderful other science fiction selections, if that's what you're into. And really, I mean, it's just this incredible library of over 60,000 titles. So whatever you're into is there. Thank you, Audible, for your support. Now, folks, since we have been waving since before the show started, and I apologize, I asked Kevin if he was on yet. You're waiting to give it a try. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't tried it out yet.
So
we had a call. I do the Supernova conference, and we had a call yesterday actually with the lead developers from Sydney at Google Wave. So we had a discussion on it, but I personally haven't actually started using it yet.
That's right. I had to miss that call. You guys are doing these great briefings calls each week, where people can listen in and talk about stuff that is current in the world of technology. And Wave is certainly current. Again, no pun intended. But did you have Dr. Wave on the call?
I don't know. Who's Dr. Wave?
I don't know. He's the guy that, if you look on YouTube, intro video that you get when you get a Wave account is this funny guy in a mock laboratory introducing you to the world of Wave.
Oh, you're ruining it for me.
I thought he wore that jacket. And the guy who developed it, yeah.
Yeah. We've been doing this today, and it's really fun. People are able to do threaded discussions within the Wave. It's real time, like our friend feed and IRC chat. But it has a lot of other facets to it as well. You can add links. You can make it public, which we did today, so folks can join in even if they're not your contacts. You can add files, you can add images. It's pretty cool. But what we were noticing too, and I've heard a lot of lawyers talk about, well, how are we going to use Wave? Because lawyers do a lot of collaboration with each other and hammering things out both on the same side of the table and from opposite sides of the table. So I think that the collaboration aspects of this will be interesting for lawyers, but also interesting and problem fraught as you see somebody's thought process unroll in real time. One of the things that is unique to Wave is as you're going along, you can see what the other person's typing before they've actually hit enter. And who knows, this is still an alpha product. Who knows if that'll be something that they keep in, but they put it there on purpose. They seem to like that feature.
We actually, if I could butt in, we had a lawyer on this call that we did yesterday, and it was just someone who called in and to ask a question, and he was saying he specialized in discovery, e-discovery in litigation, and he said to the Google guys, well, this all sounds great. How are you going to respond the first time I come to you with a subpoena asking for this incredibly complex, rich set of interactive data that you just described? The guys from Google said, that's a very interesting question. We have some very good lawyers in our company, and we'll figure it out when we come to it.
Do you remember, was that Michael McGuire?
I don't recall the name of the guy who asked the question. No, but it's certainly that this is what happens as things get more interactive and these things come together. Lawyers will have a field day as they always do.
Yes, Evan was having some real time humor fun as we fired the thing up and we're just testing 1, 2, 3. Did the link work? Okay. we seem to be here. And Evan started typing, I am sitting here without any pants. And then he erased it.
That really doesn't sound like anything I would do.
I have no
idea. And, you know, the good thing that the case law on the discovery of ephemeral data is, you know, not very well established. I think of, you know, from last year, the Bunnell case, you know, whether or not, you know, data that's just loaded temporarily into RAM is something that should be preserved, you know, pursuant to a litigation hold or something like that. So you go ahead and allege that. But now, you know, you go right ahead and try to prove it. I have pants on. I promise everyone watching.
Yes, and of course, there's always the "I was trying to be funny" defense. It may not come across as well in text.
Yes, Judge, it really is funny.
Ernie, can you see using Wave in your practice?
Not until a lot more people that I know get Wave invites and start using it. But yeah, I think it's a powerful tool. I mean, basically, what I think that it does is it combines email and text messaging. So it combines the asynchronous communication of email with the immediacy of text messaging, but it also gives you the ability to add people to a thread after it's begun, and it makes it possible for those people to catch up by reading the threads in order very easily. And so, you know, just from that standpoint alone, it gives you two ways to communicate. It also gives you a way to add people later on. So if you start a Wave conversation and then later on some other people get involved and you want to bring them up to speed, all you have to do is add them. And I think that alone is a huge feature. So the other stuff, you know, there'll be a lot of things developed and added to it, which will be great and interesting. And I'm sure people will take this all in a different direction than the developers initially conceived of, which is typical for these sorts of things. But I mean, you know, email is definitely broken or severely hampered as a form of communication in a lot of ways. And I think that this is something that enables collaborative communication to take place efficiently, you know, at least for now, until the spammers figure out how to use it.
Yeah, Gmail was such a revolution in the way email was organized when it originally came out. And I could see how this is a next logical step of having conversations grouped together, and instead of, you know, pinging back and forth in asynchronous time, actually unfolding in such real time that you can see the characters being entered as they're typed. So it's pretty compelling as a collaboration tool. I can definitely see using it on a regular basis for folks to interact with the show, which they've been doing today quite nicely. It's, you know, the IRC is great for that too, but as you said, this is something persistent that you can link to and come back to after the fact and work with. You know, it's not as ephemeral as something like IRC. It's more like friend feed in that regard. And it's, you know, part of the Google ecosystem, which makes it useful in a whole bunch of other ways. So,
and it's my understanding that there's just back up a tiny little bit before I launch into this. Clearly, most lawyers are worried about issues of confidentiality. Say, you know, you want to use it to collaborate with your client to draft some kind of document or something like that. Well, then, you know, the automatic red flag that goes up in the mind of legal counsel is, well, this is all sitting on a, you know, in a server farm somewhere outside the four walls of my organization. And have I now, you know, waived attorney-client privilege with all this stuff? From what I gather, having you know, been invited to a Wave earlier this week where there were a bunch of lawyers talking about these issues, is that if it hasn't been released already, it will be like a standalone version of this that it, I guess it's, you know, it's open source stuff, so it can sit on you know, one's own server. So that if that indeed is true, that should preempt or, you know, at least quickly answer one of the bigger objections that lawyers that I have talked to have about this. And, you know, those kinds of concerns seem to, you know, detract from, you know, the more wonderful aspects of it as a tool. So I hope that's true, that there will be the standalone version of it.
Yeah, I assume there will be. I mean, Google seems to be positioning its apps like this for business use. So that would be certainly something that's a logical step when they come out of whatever we are, alpha or beta on this. The strikes me as particularly funny once the lawyers get wind of this tool being out there and people using it is, the email disclaimers, speaking of disclaimers, as we have been, that you have to wade through when reading an email from a lawyer affiliated with a law firm are pretty horrific. And I just don't see how that would translate to this environment at all. Hopefully it will make people rethink what they need to stick at the end of their communications. I don't know. What were you going to say, Kevin?
It's lawyers. They'll make them longer. There was a funny situation that I saw where there was someone who's the official tweeter for a company, and his general counsel told him he had to put disclaimers in his tweets, because of something, SEC rule or something. And he said, "Do you understand? It's 140 characters." They said, "Well, just use a bunch of tweets for the disclaimer." So that tweet, I don't remember which company it was. That's not terribly effective.
Well, we talked about the guy at eBay who was live tweeting their earnings calls previously on the show. So it may have been that you were thinking of, because he was required to go ahead and tweet out their disclaimers.
I tell you what they need is a service. It's just a little tiny URL that you put at the end of the tweet.
Do you know any services like that?
As a matter of fact, I do. It's called Comply, CMP.ly. Go visit it. Choose your disclosure and go forth and prosper.
Oh, wow. Well, the day that lawyers actually use a service like that for their disclaimers is the day I give up trying to proselytize to the legal profession and say, okay, you guys have finally gotten it. I'm going to shut up about the way you should be using technology because you've arrived.
Lawyers like to redundantly say things multiple times, I have noticed.
Yeah, then I guess the next big hurdle would be to wean them off needing to make those disclaimers at all, or making them in language that at least they make sense, which is a pet issue of Ernie's.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, the IRS 230 circular, the world's greatest form of spam.
Yes. Yeah. So for listeners who aren't as inundated with lawyer email as we on the phone are, explain what that is, Ernie.
Well, I really do think it is spam, and remember the first spam was put out by a lawyer. So the 230 circular says if the IRS rules say if you're giving advice to a client and the client's going to try to say, oh no, this tax dodge that you say is illegal and you're trying to hold me in bad faith, I actually have a lawyer who said it was okay. So the lawyer doesn't want to be dragged into this. The IRS says, well, if you put in something saying that you're not giving tax advice, then it'll be clear you won't be held liable and brought into the fray. Essentially, that's in non-lawyer terms what that IRS 230 circular is all about. So what lawyers do is instead of saying, gee, am I practicing tax law or am I writing anything in this email that even contains the word tax? No, I'm going to make this part of my standard signature that gets generated automatically, and they have these varying lengths disclosures about IRS 230, and nothing in this email is intended to convey the impression that I'm giving tax advice. So you reply to somebody on your work email in your son's carpool, that gets popped in there and added to the noise that's being circulated on the internet. And this is because, as lawyers, of course, highly trained and able to discern individual nuances between cases, we're not able to discern the nuance that applies to this case, and we're going to use technology. Here we're definitely going to use technology for the first time and add it to everything we send out, and I think that's completely insane.
Yeah, but think of all the tax issues that arise when you're talking to the people about the carpool. Come on, there could be the fuel, there could be the deductions from I'm joking.
Is this a lead up to a new service by a friend of yours?
There's this wonderful idea.
Well, if you're Shannon D. Jackson of Hendersonville, Tennessee, you're wishing there were some sort of disclosure you could tag on to your Facebook pokes, because apparently this woman was actually arrested for poking another user on Facebook. Did you guys have the chance to check this out?
I did. And I wondered when I read that if Facebook had called this something different than poking, like notifying or, you know, a tap on the shoulder, would the judge have put the person in jail? Because I don't think everybody understood what this really was. I mean, you know, I guess he sort of understood, but the lawyer defending the woman didn't seem to understand.
Go ahead.
Well, I think somebody doesn't understand somewhere, either the court or the parties or the whomever wrote about it. Because I went and looked, and I'm pretty sure. I mean, there's a lot of granular privacy settings you can make on Facebook about, you know, who sees what and who can do what to whom, you know, poke them or whatever. And I'm convinced, and I'm hoping somebody at Facebook or somebody can, you know, again, tell me if I'm wrong on this. I don't think you can poke somebody who you're not friends with. So if this gal was poking someone else, it seems like they would have already had to have been friends. And you would think that part of the protective order that was purportedly or allegedly violated here would have included defriending, you know, the person here. And if that hadn't been done already, then there's some serious, you know, fundamental problems with this makes this story a bit fishy, I guess. Because, you know, if you're going to get violate a restraining order for poking somebody, then you would be likewise violating that restraining order just by updating your status or posting a link, because that would come through, you know, on the other person's newsfeed unless they had hidden you or somehow. So I am just very skeptical about this story at somewhat of a high level, but it's still fun to talk about just because of the little nuances of it here. I know that there have been some other cases involving MySpace, you know, before, you know, with communications. One in particular, well, I guess it was Facebook. I think I wrote about it on my blog sometime in the last year about, you know, sending somebody a message through Facebook, whether or not that was going to be witness tampering. Perhaps we've talked about it on this show before, but it's you know, a cute little story, you know, because it involves the poke.
Yes, it is. And so, somewhere along the way, somebody seems to have thought that this was, you know, an actual physical contact of some kind. Although the woman was under what's called a protective order, sounds like a restraining order, where she wasn't supposed to contact the recipient of the poke in any way. She was prohibited from telephoning, contacting, or otherwise communicating with the petitioner directly or indirectly.
See, that's what I'm talking about. If they had to have been friends, you know, unless the other person took, you know, like the petitioner took the affirmative step of hiding her from the newsfeed, then anything that she would have done on Facebook would have ended up in the feed, and that would have been in violation of the restraining order. And there just seems to be a real problem if you're just going to be, you know, talking, you know, putting up your typical status date or status update, you know, to be in violation of the protective order. That's what.
Yeah, I checked that as you were talking, and I tried to find someone I know I'm not friends with on Facebook, and I pulled up Steve Case. We have 90 mutual friends. However, we are not friends. And
but
I'm trying to see
if can you poke him?
I'm trying to see if I can poke Steve, and it does not seem that I can. I can attempt to add him as a friend, or I can view his friends. And yeah, that's it. So I think you're right about that one.
I see the opportunity for a new niche blog here, the Poke Law Blog.
And the advertising you would make off of that would be phenomenal.
Yes,
because you would probably pull in some searches that had nothing to do with Facebook on that one. So who knows?
Perhaps.
Okay, so another interesting story that came my way this week was in the New York Times, and it's about Americans and their attitudes toward online privacy. And the headline is 2/3 of Americans object to online tracking. And it goes through and talks about, you know, how people feel about being monitored online. If anyone listening is a fan of Doc Searls or Project VRM, this came my way through the Project VRM mailing list, where we like to pay attention to things like vendor relationship management, which is what VRM stands for, and the way that we can make things more user-centric. So it's interesting to see how people actually feel and what they actually know about what's happening to them as they surf around the web. The one thing I thought was really fascinating about this is they gave people questions about true or false questions about privacy laws to see how knowledgeable Americans were about protection, including if a website has a privacy policy, it means that the site cannot share information about you with other companies unless you give the website your permission. Of course, the correct answer is false, but there was only one of these questions, and it was regarding sweepstakes, that was answered correctly by more than half the respondents. So people seem to have a huge disconnect in their knowledge of what a privacy policy actually is required to do. And this is a long lead up to asking you guys what you think about the state of privacy laws in the U.S. and whether they're about to become more strict as people actually realize what's happening with their data online. Kevin, why don't you take the first crack?
Well, this is another big area that technology is moving forward, and also we have at least in Washington an administration that takes this stuff very seriously. The interesting question for me is we kind of got to an equilibrium with the web 10 or 15 years ago with privacy policy. So back when I was in government in the mid-1990s, there was a lot of debate about did there need to be rules for privacy, what were they. And eventually, you know, there was a sense that there were enough best practices out there and privacy policies became common. But as you pointed out with that statistic, it's not at all clear that people understand what those policies say. And frankly, most of them just are extremely broad in what they let sites do with data, because there's no real incentive to be any more restrictive. And now this gets harder because we've got all these new technologies and social media and so forth. So, I think the danger in the U.S. is we tend to let things go, and then respond to some crisis in a kind of sectoral way. So the joke always used to be that we for a long time in the U.S. had no medical privacy laws, but we had a videotape rental privacy law. Because Robert Bork's videotape rental records came out during his confirmation hearing for the Supreme Court. So that was deemed more important than your medical records. We now have a medical privacy law in HIPAA, which, as far as I can tell, just creates vast amounts of new work and overhead and doesn't really help all that much in keeping stuff private. So I think that it would be dangerous to rush forward to try and solve privacy problems, especially for all these new kind of social media services. I mean, we just mentioned one with Google Wave. But I think it's worth, the time is now to kind of work through and see what are some good principles. Can we use disclosure? What can we do more now with machine readable data and automation? I'll let Evan talk about his Libyan service when it gets to him. But what kinds of techniques can we use? And this is something that at Supernova we're having a track just on legal issues. Actually, Denise is going to be leading one of the sessions, but a different session is going to be on privacy and the social web. And I think we haven't fully solved it for the static traditional web. I think this is going to be the next frontier, figuring out what this means. And just to say one other thing, I think people's attitudes here are just terribly confused. I teach students, and when I teach undergrads, I ask them often things like, the first question used to be, do you use Facebook? But that's now become a joke because you ask a bunch of undergrads, do they use Facebook? They it's kind of like, do you breathe air and wear clothing? but then the question is, how do you think about information that's on Facebook? And they say, we share everything, we don't care. And then I say, well, what happens if you're interviewing for a job and someone talks about something that was made public on your Facebook profile, and they say, oh, they can't do that. That's from my friends. That's not why I put that out there. And you say, well, you should think about that. People's attitudes are really not very well formed here.
Kevin, do you have anybody on the panel at Supernova who's going to address this from the standpoint of making things more under the user's control as opposed to the user always having to agree and be bound by things that they have no control over and perhaps don't fully understand? I like the idea of marrying Evan's Libyan friends company to the VRM group and having some kind of standardized machine readable forward-facing text or statement that people could put into place for themselves and say, you know, here's what I expect if you're going to use my online data. And this is, you know, not a novel concept. The VRM folks have looked at this for a long time, a few years back, and still currently I am on the board. I have never been asked to leave the board of the Attention Trust, which again was concerned with what are you all out there in the cloud doing with my data? And how are we going to have an understanding about what expectations I have with your use? So is that something that you think your panel's going to specifically address?
I expect it would be, and you know, if it's not something that one of the speakers brings up, we have these are very interactive sessions where the audience gets involved, and I'm sure that's something people will bring up. The challenge is, as I see it, is you know what I said before, people don't generally understand their own attitudes about privacy all that well, and it gets a lot harder when you're thinking about what's my expectation of privacy on Twitter or on Google Wave. It just takes time to develop these social norms. So, you know, I think a lot of these approaches that say users own their data, we should just, you know, allow users to specify how they want to let it be shared, haven't worked that well in practice. I mean, we tried this with the P3P system, you know, back in the early days of e-commerce, and again, it, you know, part of it is user interface, and we can do better with that now. But part of it is you know. People haven't thought these things through, and so I think there's some responsibility you know, on the industry side, again, to try and figure out what's the best practice and how can we disclose things to people, and how can we, you know, again, it comes back to if you take Don't Be Evil seriously, not just for Google but for anyone, you know, not just what can we get away with someone's data, but you know, what's appropriate, what do we feel comfortable with doing so that we don't get into these problems.
Ernie, do you have any thoughts on privacy and expectations that you want to share before we move on from this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a psychological problem. I think that, and I see it, or I've seen it in a couple of instances. Like, for example, when I first started practicing law, I discovered in our law library that there was this thing called the reverse lookup phone book, where you could look up somebody's phone number and find out who that person was. And I thought this was just an amazing tool. And, you know, it was the kind of thing that private investigators used. And apparently not a lot of people knew about it. And then, you know, years later when caller ID showed up and, you know, this service was built in, people who weren't familiar with caller ID, if you showed them that their number was showing up, they were like, oh, my God, this is horrible. You know, like, who allowed this? And, you know, the same thing is true for public records. You know, when you put public records, like in Louisiana or New Orleans, we put the property records online a couple of years ago, and people were shocked that they could look up, that their neighbors could look up and see how much they paid for their house. But you could always do this. If you went down to the court records office, you could look it up. You know, it's just that people didn't know about it. And I think that that's like the trigger. You know, people, they don't know and they don't care until all of a sudden they discover it's possible and that it's being used against them. Then it bothers them. But they don't really get into the debate or try to learn about it or pay attention to it until that moment. And so then the question is, you know, should the law or should other people, you know, set up a system to deal with that when you can't really know who's going to be offended and who's not? And most likely the people who are going to be most offended are the people, you know, who just don't want to enable that form of technology. But, you know, to me it all goes back to the famous Scott McNeely quote. I mean, you just kind of have to get over the fact that we have a lot less privacy, or maybe even none, if we're in a public place or the information involved is a public record. You know, like, that's just that, you know, we want transparency until it applies to us. You know, that's really the problem.
Ernie, the way you're characterizing it really resonates with the way I've been thinking about this, and in particular the results of this study that that we're talking about here, which gauges the reactions that people have upon learning about how they're tracked online. And really in the study, there were like three different tiers of monitoring. And with each different one, people became more disdainful of how they were being monitored. You know, it's like one was like, if you're being monitored by the particular site that you're at, you know, how do you feel about that? And 2/3 of the people didn't like that. Then how do you feel about, you know, other websites tracking you and targeting advertising on the site based on that? And, you know, more people didn't like that. And then finally, there was this whole notion of you being tracked in offline, you know, like what kind of purchases you make and then having ads geared toward that. The results of this survey and this and the scientific data here underscores in my mind this whole notion that information is power. And as individuals, we recognize that when other people have information about us, they have the possibility of exerting power over you. You know, you just watch, you know, Minority Report or any, you know, number of science fiction stories that take this notion about, you know, this knowledge about you out there that's out there in the cloud, so to speak, and being used against you in certain contextual situations where other people can have this power over you. I think that one thing that makes it even more disdainful is compared to just having somebody else know something about you, what's even more irksome for people is when the individual doesn't know what this other party knows about them. And that's where it gets particularly frightening for people, because you want some kind of control over, you know, the information that's out you about there. And the thing that escalates the level of disapproval when tracking is done further away from the actual page you're on kind of hits on that same part of the human psyche that gets, you know, ticked off when a person learns that they're being gossiped about, you know, because you there's this stuff going on, there's this information that's out there about you that you don't know about and you don't have any control over. And I think that as soon as we all on both sides of the equation recognize this human dynamic, both, you know, on the individual user level and also in the sense of responsibility that the providers are going to put, you know, lay on top of this framework, the sooner we can understand that kind of human desire to participate in this information / power exchange, the better off we'll be when it comes to implementing a regulatory system to take care of it.
Right. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
I'm sorry. I wrote a paper a few years ago called Censors and Sensibilities that was taking off on Jane Austen, sort of on this point about culture and so forth. And it sort of posed the question that, yeah, that you're absolutely right. You know, that's how we feel about things intuitively. But what happens when we live in a world with 3 billion camera phones? Which is pretty close to the one we're in now, where you know, virtually everywhere you go, you're going to be around people who could be recording and broadcasting everything you're doing, and not for the purposes of surveillance. You know, they just might be video blogging about themselves, and you're in the background or something like that. And then you layer on all these other kinds of technologies where information can be tracked in so many different ways. I tend to be on the Scott McNeely side of saying we're going to have to accept this to some extent, but I think it's fair to say, well, that doesn't mean that privacy is of no value. We've got to think about what's the core that has to be protected.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, at some level, government does play a role in making sure that that happens, because someone in our wave raised a good point, Bullcut at googlewave.com, sort of a burying your head in the sand kind of approach is actually probably how people manage their anxiety about this. They sort of know that it's going on, but they don't pay attention to it. They don't know with any sort of specificity, and ignorance becomes bliss. They can go through their lives and not give it too much concern, but, you know, that's not exactly a sanguine way for someone to make policy and go forward.
The policymakers need to be somewhere between ignorance is bliss and the people who wear tinfoil hats.
Yes, that's their struggle. And I don't envy them that struggle. Back to the policymaking point. Since we have you on, Kevin, I'd love to close with this story about Chairman Jenikowski, if I'm saying that right, and his statements recently about where the FCC is going to go with net neutrality, and what he told folks at the Brookings Institution in his speech there. Where do you think, it sounds as though we're going to get some clear-cut statements from the FCC as to what they expect providers to do. Is that your understanding, and what's in progress, and when can we expect something?
The last one is the easiest one, which is next week. The FCC has an open commission meeting every month, and I think they've now publicly made statements to the effect that they plan to launch a proceeding at that point on this issue, barring some unforeseen delay that comes up. So the chairman, I think, was pretty clear and very eloquent on this issue, and really put it in context of the open internet. What I said at the beginning, that there's a set of principles that have allowed the internet to flourish, and it's important that those be preserved. But there's a whole set of difficult challenges that get raised, and the companies that operate broadband networks raise a bunch of issues about their need to manage traffic and so forth. And so the FCC doesn't just adopt rules; it puts out proposals and puts them out for comment. And again, that's already started. So if you go to openinternet.gov, you can read the chairman's speech and more information there. The next step will be the commission putting out a proposal and taking public comment. Just to summarize what the chairman said, the FCC has four existing principles, but they haven't been enforceable rules for internet openness, which deal with service providers can't block access to any site or block any use of any legitimate device. Block usage of any application, prevent there from being competition. He talked about making those enforceable. He also talked about adding a non-discrimination provision, and he talked about adding a transparency provision. And that last one, I think, is really interesting along the lines of some of the things we've talked about on this call. There's people don't know what goes on their broadband networks. Even in situations, there was a situation last year where Comcast was found to be unnecessarily and illegitimately limiting peer-to-peer traffic. And it took three or four efforts for Comcast itself to explain what it was doing, because their people didn't even know what was going on their network. So I think transparency is something. It doesn't get as much attention as some of the other ones. But that was something that the chairman talked a lot about in his speech, and I think would be an important part of this as well.
Great. Well, on that note, we can look forward to what comes out from the FCC. I'm definitely looking forward to coming and joining you at Supernova in December, and we'll go ahead and do a bit of plugging for that right now, because today is an important day if you want to attend Supernova, is it not?
Absolutely. Today's the early bird registration deadline, so if you want to save $500 on registering for Supernova, go to supernovahub.com. It's Supernova, H-U-B, supernovahub.com. That's the conference website. Sign up today, October 16th, is the cutoff before rates go up. The conference is December 1st through 3rd in San Francisco. As Denise said, she's going to be participating in one of the sessions in our legal track. We've got all kinds of fantastic people, people from the government coming, people from the entertainment industry, academics, as well as some really influential technology executives and entrepreneurs. So I hope people join us.
Yeah, I hope they do too. I'm really excited for our panel, which is going to be about social networks and the workplace. And fortunately, I didn't even have to line up the wonderful speakers that you've already put there. I just get to come in and moderate them, which is good fun. And one of them is Alex McGillivray, who's general counsel for Twitter, and is a great guy and was very instrumental before his role at Twitter in the Google Books search stuff that has been unfolding. So I'm looking forward to catching up with Alex and talking about these concerns with him, because it's all very interesting as social networking becomes more and more a part of how people communicate, like your students, Kevin, who, just look at you with eyes glazed over if you suggest they're not doing some kind of social networking activity.
They look at me with eyes glazed over for most of my lectures anyway, so that's all that was going on.
Yes, and I should note and make full disclosure when I note it, because I am involved in the conference and going to be speaking there. And Kevin has given me my own personal discount code that will get you another $200 off if you do register by today, the early early bird deadline. And it works after the deadline too. So if you happen to be listening to this after the fact and want to come, if you use DH Legal as your priority code, you get another discount there. And I get a little kickback from that. So the FTC is hopefully happy with me letting everyone know that. Evan, thank you for all the plugging and shilling you've been doing on today's show.
Hey, well, thanks for, you know, giving me the platform to do it. every time here's a lot of fun. So thanks for having me.
It's great fun to have you back too. Folks, before we leave, Kevin Werbach can find him at werbach.com, W-E-R-B-A-C-H, and can find Evan Brown, as always, at internetcases.com.
Yes, that's me.
And Ernie the Attorney, you can track down at ErnieTheAttorney.net.
That's right, or PDFForLawyers.com or DigitalWorkflowCLE.com.
Cool, and we're all on Twitter. Kevin is at KWerb. Evan is at Internet Cases. Ernie is at Ernie Attorney. I am at D Howell. And, you know, who knows? We have so many ways to connect with each other. I don't think that there's probably room in a given show to get them all in there. But those will definitely get you into our respective online universes. And we hope that you will look us up and hit us up after the show. The wave will stay up there if people want to keep participating. You can reach me at denise@twit.tv to suggest links for future shows and anything else that's on your mind. And I really appreciate everyone joining us. And I thank Muammar Gaddafi for his service to, to the American consumer.
They're not just a flag of convenience anymore.
That's right. Okay, folks, we'll see you next week.
Take care.
See you around.
Thanks.